When I came up with this topic a couple of months ago, I knew immediately the music that I wanted to go along with it. It's music by a group called Secret Garden that is one of my sources of tremendous happiness. In fact, most of my sermons are written to the background music played by Secret Garden, a violin and piano duo. And Mary and Ina have made me very happy today by offering their music. So I want to start by thanking you for that. So what does it mean to be happy? Maybe it's one of those things kind of like art. It's hard to describe, but you know it when you feel it. It's an aspect of well-being. For me, there's a component of contentment associated with it. Apparently, happiness is important in our country because the founders made a statement that one of the rights that we declared in our Declaration of Independence was the right to pursue happiness. But have we achieved it in all this pursuit? Now, if you're like me, you probably don't think very much about whether you're happy or not. I actually notice when I'm unhappy, but I don't necessarily notice when I'm happy because I'm kind of involved in being happy. It comes and it goes, happiness. But in preparation for this service, I took a test to see how happy I am. It's on the Authentic Happiness site. There's lots of tests that you can take, and if you're like me, I love to take those tests. So I took the happiness test, and I came out a 3.6 out of 5. And I was not happy about that. Now, a lot of these tests that you can find online come out of a fairly recent academic discipline called positive psychology. It started in the early 70s. Most of the psychology studies before then were about disease and problems, and positive psychology wanted to turn that around and study more about why we're happy, how good things come into our minds, and how we manage the more positive aspects of life. And there's certainly a lot of research out there, a lot of tests as well, like the one that I took. They're essentially measures of subjective well-being. They ask you a series of questions about how you feel about your life, your work, your relationships, all sorts of things. In fact, those individual tests, subjective measures, are consolidated in what is called the World Happiness Index. And you can see the ranking of all the countries in the world according to these subjective tests as well as some other measures that would indicate that the people in that country are happy. So let's see, who wants to guess who won? Oh, okay, I'm hearing some Scandinavian countries. Did anybody say Costa Rica? Costa Rica wins every measure, wins in every test, wins on every website that measures worldwide happiness. Kind of a statement that money doesn't buy happiness, huh? Costa Rica has 1/4 of the GDP of the United States. But they have the lowest scores in loneliness, and they have the highest scores in social connections. So let me turn to the book now that prompted this sermon, my well dog-eared copy and heavily marked copy of The Happiness Hypothesis by Jonathan Haidt. The subtitle is Finding Modern Truth in Ancient Wisdom. He combines the ideas of Buddha, Aristotle, ancient Roman philosophers, Chinese and other East Asian philosophers with 21st century positive psychology. He distills this down into 11 chapters and 45 pages of notes and references. Now, I found about 30 brave souls who were willing to meet with me for 4 months in a row to discuss this book and what we found. And in the last session of our book groups, I asked them to tell me what I should preach about on June 26th that I am now standing in front of you doing. And the first thing they said was, there's quite a lot in here, and I think that it's more than one sermon. That was the most common thing that people said. Far too many ideas. So what I'm going to do for you today is really kind of give you the framework of the main point of this book. And I imagine that some of the other chapters are going to creep into sermons in the future because they've kind of crept into my consciousness. But you need to turn to your front cover of your order of service now to see the formula that was just that a group of positive psychologists came up with in the 90s. H equals S plus C plus V. I chose the little picture of the woman drawing her own smiley face. I have to give myself credit for that. It's like creating your own happiness, right? Drawing your own smiley face. Because that's kind of the point of the book and the formula, is that there are some things that you can control to create your own happiness, and there are other things that you can't. And you might actually be surprised about which are which. So H obviously equals happiness. S is the set point. It's what you were given in your genes, your genetic, how you're genetically determined to be. And depending upon which study you look at, it indicates 33 to 90% of whether you're going to be happy or not. So if you are the child of gloomy parents, you have a challenge ahead of you. And if you inherited a sunny disposition, you should consider that you have won the genetic lottery. So that's the S, the set point. C is conditions. These are generally, this formula means conditions that are external to your life, external to things that are inside of you and your thoughts. So some of these you can control and some of them can't. Where you live can affect your happiness. How long your commute is. What conditions you have at work. How much money you have is one of the conditions that affect your happiness, but not as much as you would think. In fact, studies in the United States that have shown that for a family of four, happiness increases up to $75,000 a year, and then it doesn't increase after that. That's the threshold. And really, if you think about it, it is you have your housing and your food, and it's like you have enough money to not have to constantly be worried about having enough money. Now, with our median family income around $45,000, that places most of the people in our country below that threshold of where money is not a factor for them in their happiness. Now, it doesn't mean that people who have less money aren't happy, as the Costa Rica example gives us. In fact, one of the conditions that really, really matters in happiness is how much control you have in your life, how much control you have over things that affect you. One of the studies that was done and reported in the book was in a nursing home that had two floors. On the first floor, they gave everyone plants, and they gave them, there were other things they had, but somebody took care of all of it. You didn't have to, you think that would be great, right? You don't have to worry about anything. On the second floor, they had plants, they had other things, but the residents were responsible for taking care of them. Guess which floor had, after, you know, several months of this, which floor had the higher reported happiness? The people who had some sense of control over things in their life. Of course, relationships are an important part of the conditions that create happiness. Love in your life, people who have some source of unconditional love in a childhood, it can transcend all other difficulties. So the condition of love is critical. Having nature in your life is a condition that can make a difference in your happiness. So these are the external conditions that affect your happiness. Now the V in this, I don't like the V, but I wanted to go with their use of that letter. V refers to voluntary things, but really the V returns to the internal things that you can do that are about how you view the world. Now in this book, every chapter starts with a few quotes that set the stage. And this point about the internal things that you have control over, that you can change, is such a critical point. I wanted to bring in some of these quotes that can help sort of jog your mind a little bit to connect with them. The first one's from Dale Carnegie. Some of you may know him. He was a 20th century motivational speaker. Dale Carnegie said, "It isn't what you have or what you are or where you are or what you are doing that makes you happy or unhappy. It is what you think about." Now, Marcus Aurelius was a Roman philosopher from the first century, and he said, "Very little is needed to make a happy life. It is all within yourself, in your way of thinking." Abraham Lincoln, mid-19th century president in our country, said, "Most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be." And a early 21st century minister, Lucy Bunch, says, "You can't control what happens to you, but you can control how you react to it." So what's the common thread in these quotes? That some of these conditions for happiness are within your control, are actually inside your own head and your own body. So this is one of the most important ideas in this book, that happiness comes from within. And when we start to engage with that premise, it's important to think more holistically about what we mean by within. In our modern thinking, and by modern I mean like the last 200 or 300 years of thinking, we've been taught that there's like the mind and the body and the unconscious and the conscious, and they're separate pieces. And that's kind of resulted in some challenges for how we live our lives, because the unconscious in us has a lot more authority and control than we give it credit for. The author, Jonathan Haidt, talks about controlled things that we do, the things that we reason and think about, and the automatic that we do. And he calls the controlled things the rider, and the automatic things, which I'm kind of doing everything from my head down, he calls them the elephant. Now, the idea when you first hear that is like, okay, the rider's in charge and the elephant does what the rider says to do, right? Because the rational mind's in charge and the elephant takes orders. Yeah, not so much. The elephant is in charge of all the automatic processes that go back pre-human, all the instinctual things. And automatic processes are all running many times at once, way ahead of those slow, cumbersome, rational thoughts that we have. These automatic processes drive our judgments, our gut feelings, visceral reactions. They're the source of our intuition. So in reality, our conscious controlled system, our rational mind, is much more like an advisor placed on the back of this elephant to help the elephant make better choices. But if you think of the rider on the elephant, what do you have to work with here? You got yelling, right? Look out, elephant! You've got a little tiny whip, right? Great big elephant. You can kick your heels on the elephant. But if the elephant sees something at once, if the elephant doesn't want to go somewhere, if the elephant has different ideas, you forget it. So the perfect example of this, and lots of good opportunities for stories in my life, is dieting. We start out with a lot of willpower, right? We have a plan, right? Right? And then what happens? Well, the elephant wants that cookie. There's a couple of examples in my life. One of them is I call cookie amnesia. This is where I buy myself a little treat and I say, okay, once you write the 10 pages of the sermon, you can eat the cookie. So I work away, and then I look up. There's no cookie. The elephant ate the cookie while my rational mind was busy typing away. The other way the elephant influences my food choices is in restaurant ordering. I'm a big Dos Coyotes fan. Love this one particular burrito. really like this one salad. But, you know, come on, the burrito wins, right? So I go in there, and I'm in line, yin-yang salad, I'm in line, I'm ready, I get up there. Can I take your order, please? Ranchero burrito. The elephant wins. Another way our elephant speaks to us and controls us is, have you ever had the experience where, like, you're about to go into some place or do something, and you're like, I don't want to go in there. I don't want to do that. I don't want to say that, right? Even though your rational mind, it's particularly hard when we need to speak up about things that are important to us. That elephant's like, forget it. You've got it all worked out in your head. Last summer, I preached about the idea of implicit racism, how we're hardwired to have judgments about people that are different from us. That's the elephant. That's what we're countering in these emotional responses to things. And you can see how that's playing out in our world right now. So what does the elephant and the rider have to do with happiness? Well, remember the point about V, the internal things that you have, you can choose to control. If you're going to make any progress on controlling some of your own inner thoughts and processes, you're going to have to work on the relationship between the elephant and the rider. If you neglect the subconscious aspects of yourself, you're just setting yourself up for challenges and frustration. It's part of a process of understanding yourself and loving yourself and being patient with yourself, a training process not just of the elephant but of the rider, learning how to manage your expectations and your reactions. All these will help you create the conditions of well-being. Now, here's another quote to offer you from Mahatma Gandhi. Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony. This is right back to our rider and our elephant, this idea of coherence in all of our parts. The rider and the elephant are on the same page. So how do you do that? Where do you start? Where do you start building this relationship, training both the rider and the elephant so that you have a chance to set the conditions for happiness in your life, particularly if you started out with a gloomy or pessimistic view of the world? Well, Jonathan Haidt, our author here, gives us three suggestions. The first one, a 21st century option, is medication. A reality for a lot of people, and we should be grateful we live in the 21st century where depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, all the things that cause a lot of unhelpful mind activity can be managed through medication. His second one comes from the ancient side, and it is another form of mind management that many of you are familiar with, meditation. Meditation actually changes the automatic processes of your life. It's like taming the elephant. But as any of you who have practiced meditation know, that you're also training the rider. Those early beginnings of meditation, you're told to just, when your mind wanders, bring back to whatever your focus is, whether it's your breath or silence or a word. Those early days, forget it. Your mind, you need patience, you need humility to recognize that the simple task of sitting with a single thought in your mind is a very difficult task, but one that yields tremendous, tremendous rewards because you're building that relationship between the rider and the elephant. I came to meditation through Buddhism. And one of the greatest gifts that I received through this process was learning that I didn't have to pay attention to what was going on in my head, that I could label it like monkey mind. You know, sometimes you get stuck on worries and you have this track running of concerns. I learned that I didn't have to give it any credence, that through my meditation practice, it gave me the power to tell the elephant, chill out, elephant, we'll get to it. So the third thing that Haidt raises in our attempts to have this coherence and this relationship between the rider and the elephant is somewhat of a combination between the ancient and modern. The modern version is cognitive therapy. It was developed in the 1960s by a psychiatrist named Aaron Beck. And the idea of changing the negative feedback loops in our minds by recognizing them and thinking a more positive thought. Very, very simple, but like meditation, challenging to do, but yields tremendous rewards. You're training the elephant. Now, some of you listening would probably also recognize that the ancient form of cognitive therapy is the Eightfold Path of Buddhism. Processes of all the aspects of your life and how to manage your thoughts, how to manage what you say, what you do, laid out 500 years before the Common Era. There's also more contemporary ways, and I'm sure actually people in ancient times have been doing this for some time, is to find the positive things that are strengths in your life and cultivate them. So if you have some way that you engage in the world in a positive way and you find it to be gratifying, do more of it. Engage with it more often. This is what builds sort of that muscle of managing the negativity and reinforcing the positive. In our book group, we looked at a list of virtues that one could practice, kind of a la Benjamin Franklin. Those of you who are familiar with Benjamin Franklin's work on practicing virtues, and qualities that come with the virtues, like curiosity or integrity, kindness, gratitude, forgiveness. And people picked one of those virtues that they felt was something that they could do, something that was possible for them, something maybe that they were already doing. And we talked about how you could develop a more positive approach to life by just working on that quality, working on that strength. Someone in our class actually was a gratitude practitioner, and she brought a gratitude notebook for every person in the class because her strength practice was to write down 5 things of gratitude every day. Working on a positive reinforcement so that becomes part of the neural pathways in your brain. The author of the book teaches lower division psychology classes and has all these great assignments. My favorite one is that he made the assignment that you had to be a better person by the end of the semester. So what you had to do is you had to find a strength that you had. You had to propose a plan for how you were going to work on it, and then it had to state at the end how you had become a better person. One person realized that one of her strengths was ingratitude, and so she would write down a person that she felt grateful to and something that they had done, and then she would make an in-person appointment once a week with someone, and she would express her gratitude to them for what they had done for her. And at the end of the week, end of the semester, she was able to articulate in her paper how this practice had opened her heart, deepened her connections with people, how she truly felt like a better person. And, you know, obviously she got an A in the class. One of our members here in the congregation told me about a practice that he has recently. He's had a lot of health and challenges in his life, a lot of things that would discourage and depress many of us. He's also wanting to find a way to connect with the greater world. So whenever he has a day where he feels really discouraged, he writes a small check to some organization that is making a difference in the world, like a $10 check. And for a moment, he's transported out of his own pain, his own fears, his own worries, into a place of care. And of course, the people he sends the check to, they don't know what he's doing. He's reinforcing positive connections that are making a difference in his life and helping him not to dwell on the negative. So the main conclusion, in fact, the happiness hypothesis that he's testing in this book, is when we draw on both ancient wisdom and modern science, we can conclude that happiness comes from both without and within. And that this coherence, this idea of what you think, what you say, and what you do being all the same, is a profound way of creating the fertile field from which happiness can arise. Now, some of these conditions are outside yourself: relationships, community, physical conditions, purpose, finding purpose in life, a sense of connection and meaning is profound. But happiness is not something that you can acquire. It's not something you can pursue it, but it may run faster than you can run in your pursuit. Happiness comes when you get the conditions right, when you create the space, when you create the life, the conditions of life where happiness can arise. It's kind of like grace. You can't make it happen, but you can try to cultivate a life both internally and externally that creates the conditions for happiness. The poem by Linda Pastan was a perfect example of a life creating those conditions of happiness, the poem that Molly read earlier in the service. She's reflecting on a moment of grace in the normal doings of the day. She says, "I didn't even guess that I was happy. The small irritations that are like salt on melon were what I dwelt on, though in truth, they simply made the fruit taste sweeter. So we sat on the porch in the cool morning sipping hot coffee. Behind, the news of the day, strikes and small wars, a fire somewhere. I could see the top of your dark head. And though not a public conflagration, but how your head would feel on my bare shoulder. If someone could stop the camera then, if someone could only stop the camera and ask me, 'Are you happy?' Perhaps I would have noticed how the morning shone in the reflected color of lilacs. 'Yes,' I might have said, and offered a steaming cup of coffee." May you find such moments of grace in your life. May you find what you need to get coherence and your rider and your elephant riding off in the sunset to live happily ever after. So may it be. Blessed be.